Collins.
Peter B. Collins, news and comment. It's Tuesday, June 2nd, 2020. Can Donald Trump actually declare Antifa to be a domestic terrorism group? It's murky. They are not a publicly organized group with a leader and a storefront or even a post office box. And I want to explore Antifa a little bit as we open up the podcast today on day 7 of the Summer of Rage 2020. And this begins with a comment I received in reaction to my remarks in yesterday's podcast about Antifa from listener Barbara Watson. And she wrote, "Your negative description of Antifa is unwarranted. Last year, I met some members of Antifa who were in Berkeley at the fundraiser for Mumia Abu-Jamal. The Antifa members in Berkeley were merely tackling a right-winger who was pepper-spraying protesters." I think she's referring to the events at the Milo Yiannopoulos speech, which was scuttled because of the street skirmishes. She said one of the Antifa members who went is a teacher in Oakland. She was attacked by the police, not the other way around. Then she suggests that I read Black Flags and Windmills by Scott Crowe. And Barbara, I have read that book, and I've interviewed Scott Crowe, who describes himself as an anarchist and not aligned with Antifa. But I do understand the arguments he makes as a nonviolent anarchist. But to your point about Antifa, I respect your point of view. I have never met a person who told me that he or she is a member of Antifa. And, of course, we have no way of confirming that. It is, an assertion that somebody can make. But so far, we haven't developed any way to say, oh, yeah, you definitely are, or that is simply a claim that you are making. And likewise, I have a statement that is attributed to Antifa and a self-described person who doesn't give a name, but who says that he or she has been managing a Facebook page called Antifa since 2017. And I believe this is credible. It was forwarded to me by one of my local Facebook friends, Mike Wolpert. So let's assume that it is genuine. It's addressed to all media. Public statement from Antifa in response to the threats issued by United States President Donald J. Trump. Dear Mr. Trump, let us be clear. Antifa isn't an organization. There's no membership, no meetings, no dues, no rules, no leaders, no structure. It is literally an idea and nothing more. Even the claim of this author, the person whose voice I'm reading, to represent Antifa is one made unilaterally for the purposes of this communication and nothing more. There is no governing body nor trademark owner to dispute the author's right to represent Antifa. Antifa is a neologism constructed from a contraction of the phrase anti-fascist. The truth is, there's no such thing as being anti-fascist. Either you are a decent human being with a conscience, or you are a fascist. The ostensible President of the United States has today openly declared that he is a fascist and that he intends to turn the military power of the United States into a fascist tool. Now there is no question, and we can stop pretending that this man represents anything but the worst in humanity, which his supporters embody. It will likely be no problem for LEO, that's law enforcement organizations, to identify the author of this document, who has also maintained the Antifa page on Facebook since founding it in 2017. The author is unconcerned with that inevitability because neither the author nor this document has been involved in a crime of any sort in any way. But since both the, quote, president and the media insist on acting as though Antifa is this big, scary organization, the author supposes it's time for Antifa to make a statement. Thus, Antifa supports and defends the right of all people to live free from oppressive abuse of power, whether that power is unjustly derived from wealth, status as an employer, or political popularity. Particularly, Antifa defends and supports the right of oppressed and marginalized people to protest, march, and engage in civil disobedience in pursuit of justice. While it is never our intent to engage in violent or destructive behavior, we cannot and will not take responsibility for telling people how they are allowed to be righteously outraged. We prefer and encourage nonviolent action. We also understand that some people just aren't feeling that nice anymore. Their feelings are entirely justified, and it is neither our role nor our privilege to tell them otherwise. Mass civil disobedience is what happens when people say they're hurting, and whoever's hurting them refuses to stop. Stop hurting them. Fix your broken systems. Get real and meaningful psychological evaluations and background checks. Police in some nations have to pass a more stringent test to carry pepper spray than any police department in the U.S. or the U.S. military have in place. As a direct and possibly deliberate consequence, our military and paramilitary personnel simply cannot be assumed to be fighting in the interests of the people of this country. We've all seen the photos. This destruction and burning and looting is largely the behavior of outsiders. White people taking advantage of the situation both to enrich themselves by looting under cover of the protests and to provide excuses for uncontrolled fascist elements within our military and police forces as plausible cover for killing more black, brown, and poor people without fear of sanction. The so-called accelerationists who have committed to ensuring that anytime a marginalized community stands up and demands justice, construct a narrative of criminality and destruction that white bigots and affluent oligarchs who benefit from our broken system to validate their bigotry and injustice retroactively. They are successful in this for two reasons. Because people like you are easily manipulated in your banal, self-serving ignorance, and because people like you are more than happy to passive-aggressively reap the benefits of pretending to believe this destruction is the act of the oppressed. And I just want to remind you, I'm reading verbatim this post addressed to all media from a person claiming to speak for Antifa. I continue. This game has gone on for decades in an endless loop since the very dawn of the civil rights era. We the people are saying, no more. And that, President Trump, is your solution. No more. Get the dirt out of your law enforcement and your military. Get the dirt out of your government and administration. Ideally, resign now and take your VP and cabinet with you. Nancy Pelosi isn't a great deal of improvement. She'll only be president for a few months. You can't arrest 100 million of us, sir. And you would be well advised not to try. If you think that targeting and making an example of the author of this document will get you anywhere, you may rest assured that this author is more than prepared to allow his real name to be used as a rallying cry for justice and civil disobedience from coast to coast. It's time for you and everyone who thinks like you to understand that whether black, red, brown, white, or any other color, Americans are done living in a nation of empty platitudes and broken promises. And then he lists a series of demands. Universal single-payer health care without regard for citizenship status. Universal basic income with a federal job guarantee making the government the employer of last resort. Abolition of right-to-work laws. Publicly funded higher education. Robust and effective social welfare programs, including child care, education, employment, training, counseling, parenting skills training, life skills training, including fiscal education. A requirement that functional proficiency in media, political, and economic literacy be demonstrated to graduate high school. The creation of a publicly funded nonpartisan media source to serve as the primary source of government information. Federal charges of treason filed against anyone willfully and knowingly attempting to minimize public perception of the impact and risks of the coronavirus. Reform of whistleblower laws. So that's the end of the list of demands. It's a pretty interesting menu, I have to say. And here's the closer. In the end, Mr. Quote, President, the simple reality is that Antifa isn't a thing. You can't end it, you can't arrest it, and you can't silence it. Nor in any decent nation would the attempt even be made. Antifa means anti-fascism. The only position that opposes that is fascism. In the end, there is no organization that you can declare terrorists. You, sir, and yours are the terrorists, and your victims are done putting up with it. So that's a pretty powerful statement. And again, because of the clandestine nature of this loosely organized, you can't even call them a group. They are, like-minded individuals, I guess is the best way to describe them. And I think it speaks volumes. And while I do believe that there are some people who call themselves Antifa, who have been on the streets of America in the past week, I also believe that there are black bloc anarchists, there are opportunistic looters who are not making a political statement, and there's a whole range of right-wing, pro-gun, pro-Trump provocateurs, including some who could be on the government payroll. That's happened in the past, and we can't exclude it from the present day. And this creates a very complex situation to deal with. Now, as the protests have been confined to daytime hours because of widespread curfews, the police brutality in many respects has declined in the last 48 hours. There are exceptions, as we will cover here. But even NBC News is acknowledging that one group that is described as a national Antifa organization is actually linked to a white national group identifying itself, white nationalist, sorry, as Identity Evropa or Europa. They spell the second letter with a V. A spokesman over at Twitter said that the account had violated the company's platform manipulation and spam policy. They suspended the account after a tweet that incited violence. It read like this. Oh, it came from a newly created account, Antifa_US. Tonight's the night, comrades, with a brown raised fist emoji. Tonight we say, fuck the city, and we move into the residential areas, the white hoods, and we take what's ours. Now, Twitter has taken action against Identity Europa in the past. And there were two hashtags that trended worldwide on Twitter, falsely claiming there was a cover-up or a blackout of protests in Washington, D.C. overnight. Both appeared to insinuate that protesters had been silenced in some way, perhaps by a secret internet blackout. Well, I'll offer this comment. I'm not the biggest user of Twitter, but over the weekend, as I was following televised coverage of the protests, some of the police violence, some of the hooliganism, if you want to call it that, the looting that was going on, I noticed that CNN stopped covering the scene at the White House on Friday night, and that was about 10:30 or 11 p.m. Pacific time, so between 1 and 2 a.m. in Washington. But as I followed Twitter, there were posts that continued from the scene in Lafayette Square across from the White House, including some scenes of police brutalizing the protesters there. And on Friday night, there was this back and forth as we were told it was Secret Service officers and some park police in Washington who were lined up, and they had these little portable fence units, barricades. And they engaged in a sequence of tugs of war with protesters who would grab a hold of these barricades and pull them away. And, of course, it was kind of an endless game. The protesters would get one section of it, and the government cops would just bring in another one. But it did provoke some fights that were not televised on CNN or MSNBC, but I did see captured in short videos on Twitter. So yesterday, after my deadline, Trump gave a brief speech from the Rose Garden of the White House. And as he spoke, the boom and sound waves of tear gas canisters being fired against protesters could be heard by the media who are covering Trump's Law and Order Nixonian speech. And Trump just said, you know, similar stuff that he had said on the conference call with the governors. And we're now learning that it was Bill Barr, the attorney general, who called for the forcible removal of peaceful protesters before Trump sallied forth from the White House with Barr, with his latest press secretary, McElhaney is her name, and a couple of other of his appointed officials. But according to two federal law enforcement officers, the decision had been made late Sunday night to extend the perimeter around Lafayette Square by one block. And when Barr got to the White House in the afternoon, before the presentation by the president, and then the president's determination for a photo op, where he is seen striding from the White House across the street to the church, St. John's Church, which had been partially damaged. A small fire in its basement, which took place, I believe, on Saturday night. So police, reinforced by National Guard troops, forcibly pushed back protesters outside the White House. Now, one of the things that Trump claimed in his speech was that he defended the rights of First Amendment protest. But not if they get in the way of his swagger. And so tear gas and some, you know, major shoving of people who were kind of stunned because they weren't breaking any laws, they weren't confronting the array of guards and police who'd been deployed there. And in Trump's speech, he said, I am dispatching thousands and thousands of heavily armed soldiers. We believe the number is still under 1,000 as of today. He continued, military personnel and law enforcement officers to stop the rioting, looting, vandalism, assaults, and the wanton destruction of property. We will end it now. So, you know, this fits his TV persona. He's essentially telling the protesters and the looters, you're fired. And he is going to enforce that using the military. Now, the bizarre thing is, as he went to St. John's Church, he carried a Bible with him. Now, I'd have to do a video and photographical search online, but I've never seen Trump carry a Bible. And many people I know who are believers and who revere the Bible say that he didn't even know how to hold it. And the president's choice to use the church and a Bible as photo ops deeply offended Bishop Marianne Edgar Booty, who issued a response. The president just used a Bible in one of the churches of my diocese as a backdrop for a message antithetical to the teachings of Jesus and everything that our church stands for. To do so, he sanctioned the use of tear gas by police officers in riot gear to clear the churchyard. I am outraged, the statement said. And I've been critical of the Roman Catholic bishops for their failure to confront Trump on so many issues related to humanity, human rights, and the right to life after birth, as they traded away their credibility for Trump's pandering on abortion and contraception. But today I have to praise the Archbishop of Washington, Wilton Gregory. He happens to be African-American. And he joined the chorus of critics of Trump's behavior because after the photo op at St. John's Episcopal Church, Trump and First Lady Melania took the whale, I think they call that, the presidential limo, into Northeast Washington to the St. John Paul II National Shrine. And they conducted a second photo op there. And Archbishop Gregory had this to say. I find it baffling and reprehensible that any Catholic facility would allow itself to be so egregiously misused and manipulated in a fashion that violates our religious principles, which call us to defend the rights of all people, even those with whom we might disagree. Gregory noted the legacy of Pope John Paul II, suggesting he would not have condoned Trump's actions, including his walk to St. John's and the visit to the memorial to St. Pope John Paul II. His legacy bears vivid witness to the truth of his defense of the rights and dignity of human beings. He certainly would not condone the use of tear gas and other deterrents to silence, scatter, or intimidate them for a photo opportunity in front of a place of worship and peace. Then, political leaders piled on, and not just Democrats. Here is the Senate Democratic leader, Chuck Schumer. After the president's reality show ended last night, while the nation nervously watched the chaos that engulfs us, Trump probably laid in bed pleased with himself for descending another rung on the dictatorial ladder. He probably wore out his remote control watching the clips of Attorney General Barr's victory over the unarmed in the Battle of Lafayette Square. It's all so sad, so pathetic, so weak. And Nancy Pelosi, who makes no secret of her role as a practicing Catholic, she appeared before reporters at the Capitol, wielding her own Bible, quoting the book of Ecclesiastes, urging the president, that's Ecclesiastes, I'm sorry, urging the president to focus on a time to heal, adding that the aggressive scene that played out in Washington on Monday had no place in the nation's capital. Quote, we would hope that the president of the United States would follow the lead of so many other presidents and be a healer-in-chief and not a fanner of the flame. And this brought out this comment from a Republican Senator Ben Sasse of Nebraska. And, of course, he embraced the president's law and order message. There's no right to riot, no right to destroy others' property, no right to throw rocks at police. But there is a fundamental constitutional right to protest. And I'm against clearing out a peaceful protest for a photo op that treats the Word of God as a political prop. Now, this is interesting because I have talked about the failure of evangelicals to reject Trump's pandering. And that comment from Senator Sasse is welcome. Then Tim Scott, the only black Republican in the U.S. Senate, asked and answered, if your question is, should you use tear gas to clear a path so the president can go have a photo op? The answer is no, said Senator Scott. And meanwhile, Representative Adam Smith, the Democrat of Washington State, chair of the House Armed Services Committee, is calling for Secretary of Defense Mark Esper and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Mark Milley, to testify before lawmakers. Milley was put in charge of something by Trump. He didn't specify what. He said he's bringing in thousands and thousands of troops, and I have told you the number is far lower so far, and putting a guy who doesn't have any command role in the military. The Joint Chiefs of Staff is a job where you coordinate as a member of the National Security Council. And Trump made some comment about General Milley that he's a tough guy, he's fought a lot, never lost. I don't know that to be true. And then Mark Esper, he is the former Raytheon executive who plays Secretary of Defense these days. And he started talking about how we need to dominate the battle space. Chairman Smith said language like that is deeply concerning in terms of how the military could be used for domestic law enforcement. And I've been critical of Abigail Spanberger. She's a first-term Democrat in the House from Virginia and a former CIA officer. And when she and others ran for office in 2018, I deplored the recruitment of soldiers and spies to populate what is now the Democratic majority in the House. but she cited her experience in the agency and called his response the type of action undertaken by authoritarian regimes throughout the world. "I know this playbook," Spanberger said, "and I know the president's actions are betraying the very foundation of the rule of law he purports to support." And I want to share with you a comment posted on Facebook by a friend named David Glick. He is a psychotherapist and a man who, I believe, expresses feelings that we all have. "Today, June 1st, 2020, will go down in history as one of the most important dates in the life of the nation. On this day, Donald J. Trump, the autocratic, corrupt, racist, gaslighting, sociopathic thug in the White House, declared himself to be the president's savior and supreme law and order commander of the Confederacy. Speaking in the Rose Garden, Trump shocked the nation with his seditious declaration of war on all those states and municipalities, whether governed by Democrats or Republicans, who do not embrace his white nationalism. Across the country, cheers were heard from some of his KKK and Nazi followers. Then he triumphantly walked over to St. John's Episcopal Church, which he never has attended, held up a Bible he has never read, and posed for a bizarre photo shoot to ensure the moment would be commemorated in history. Make no mistake, Trump has brought us to the brink. We as a nation must now decide if we want to live as a democracy committed to the common good or live in an American-style totalitarian fascist state under the great leader, capital G, capital L, the very stable genius whose wisdom surpasses that of all mortal men. Trump has shown his true colors. Now we must be prepared to show ours." So as Trump flanks himself with generals, invokes a military-style rule of the United States, the most recent previous chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Martin Dempsey, wrote on Twitter that America is not a battleground. Our fellow citizens are not the enemy. And Tony Thomas, a general and former head of the Special Ops Command, tweeted, "The battle space of America, ? Not what America needs to hear, ever, unless we are invaded by an adversary or experience a constitutional failure, that is, a civil war." So what we're seeing here, too, is troubling, because Trump has not actually invoked the available authorities. He's got the 1807 Sedition Act, and more recently, Obama's National Defense Authorization Act with the domestic incarceration clause in it. He has simply ordered the military to deploy, and so far they have. And at what point will the current military brass refuse an order, an illegal order, like an order to shoot to kill civilians, from this president? There's a resolution on the Senate floor today, unlikely to pass, resolved by the Senate that it is the sense of Congress that the constitutional rights of Americans to peaceably assemble, exercise freedom of speech, and petition the government for redress of grievances must be respected, that violence and looting are unlawful, unacceptable, and contrary to the purpose of peaceful protest, and that Congress condemns the President of the United States for ordering federal officers to use gas and rubber bullets against Americans who were peaceably protesting in Lafayette Square in Washington, D.C., on the night of June 1, 2020, thereby violating the constitutional rights of those peaceful protesters. Over at consortiumnews.com today, there are a pair of reports that I want to recommend to you, both related to the militarization of police in this country. The first is by Tom Nolan, who is described as a 27-year police veteran who now writes about abusive police policies. And he says, "In the past week, night after night, angry protesters have taken to the street. So, too, have police officers dressed in full riot gear and backed by an arsenal that any small military force would be proud of. Armored vehicles, military-grade aircraft, rubber and wooden bullets, stun grenades, sound cannons, and tear gas canisters. The militarization of police departments has been a feature of U.S. domestic law enforcement since the 9/11 attacks. What is clear from the latest round of protest and response is that despite efforts to promote de-escalation as a policy, police culture appears to be stuck in an us-versus-them mentality. And he continues, as a former police officer of 27 years, a scholar who has written on the policing of marginalized communities, I have observed the militarization of the police firsthand. I've seen through decades in law enforcement that police culture tends to privilege the use of violent tactics and non-negotiable force over compromise, mediation, and peaceful conflict resolution. It reinforces a general acceptance among officers of the use of any and all means of force available when confronted with real or perceived threats to officers. The police have deployed a militarized response to what they accurately or inaccurately believe to be a threat to public order, private property, and their own safety. It is in part due to a policing culture in which protesters are often perceived as the enemy. Indeed, teaching cops to think like soldiers and learn how to kill has been part of a training program popular among some police officers. Then he takes on the Defense Logistics Agency, that's at the Pentagon, their 1033 program. And that has enabled my peaceful county here in California, Marin County, to buy a Bearcat. That's this heavily armored vehicle. It's a personnel carrier. It's equipped with all kinds of, you know, high-tech gizmos. And I don't believe it's ever been deployed. If so, it's just to keep the engine running. But this has happened all over the country. And he writes about a study published in 2017. Quote, even controlling for other possible factors in police violence, more militarized law enforcement agencies were associated with more civilians killed each year by police. When a county goes from receiving no military equipment to $2.5 million worth, and that's the largest figure that went to any one agency, more than twice as many civilians are likely to die in that county the following year. Yeah, when you got the gear, you got to use it, right? Also at Consortium News, Jake Johnson, who is a reporter at Common Dreams, he writes about a new effort to cut off the 1033 program, led by Hawaii Senator Brian Schatz. On Sunday, he said he plans to introduce an amendment to end a federal program that permits the transfer of excess military equipment to police departments across the country. And I think that is a smart and welcome move. Now, there has been some accountability for the police brutality and the excess of law enforcement in the past week. So on Monday, the police chief of Louisville, Kentucky, was fired after the mayor learned that officers involved in a shooting the night before that killed the popular owner of a barbecue restaurant failed to activate their body cameras during that sequence of events. And the chief, Steve Conrad, was also in charge at the time of the recent murder of an innocent woman when the cops broke down the door in a drug investigation. So the mayor of Louisville, Greg Fisher, revealed that authorities lacked body camera video for the investigation, and the governor, Andy Beshear, also chimed in that that was completely unacceptable. Also in Atlanta, arrest warrants have been issued for six Atlanta cops after video footage from Saturday night showed them stopping two college students in a car, firing tasers at them, and dragging them out of their vehicle. The six officers are accused of a series of crimes, including aggravated assault, illegally pointing a taser, and criminal damage to property. And one of the occupants of the vehicle, 20-year-old Tania Pilgrim, she spoke at a news conference today. I hope every police officer who thinks it's okay to drag someone, beat someone, do all this stuff because they're cops, I hope they are all going to be held accountable as well. And I described that scene for you yesterday. The cops bashed in, shattered the driver's side window of the car, and cops approached from both sides with their tasers deployed. issuing these electric shocks to people who had no idea what was going on. Now, police are on the receiving end as well, I want to be fair. An officer in Las Vegas is in critical condition today after being shot near the Circus Hotel and Casino on the Strip. In an unrelated episode, a person carrying several firearms was killed after he opened fire on police forces guarding a federal building on Las Vegas Boulevard. In St. Louis, four officers were struck by gunfire in a shootout between gunmen at a protest and the police. The officers' injuries believed to be non-life-threatening. And in both New York City, in the Bronx, actually, a New York officer was run over by a black sedan at about 12:45 a.m. Also, upstate in Buffalo, New York, the driver of an SUV sped through a line of law enforcement officers in riot gear, injuring two of them. And these could be people who were reacting to the widely viewed video footage of the cops in Brooklyn who rammed their squad SUVs into live human beings. Now, there was another night of looting in Manhattan. We had reports here in Long Beach, California, and there were a number of communities across the country. It has diminished, but it hasn't stopped. And here is a scene in Los Angeles. A black woman identified as Monet was there with her husband and brother-in-law, standing guard over a cluster of local businesses. One of the stores was theirs. And they were able to confront and get some looters to at least move on. So at one point, there were some looters who rolled up, followed by uniformed officers who had been flagged down by Monet and one of her family members. But when the cops arrive, it is Monet and her relatives who are ordered to face the wall as police tie their hands and take them into custody. It's hard to defend that kind of behavior. And the cops have been missing in action in so many cases where the looting has been occurring in plain view. And here's an unusual anecdote from Manhattan. Two young attorneys, 31-year-old Uruj Rahman and 32-year-old Colinford Mattis, have been released on $250,000 bond. They are accused of tossing the equivalent of a Molotov cocktail, a homemade incendiary device, into an empty NYPD van parked outside the 88th Precinct. Well, at least they'll know where to find a lawyer. Also in Los Angeles, the police chief, who spells his name M-I-C-H-E-L, Chief Michael Moore, I guess the way that's how he pronounces it, he addressed the media and offered this kind of bizarre equivalency as he threatens to crack down on looters.
As for the safety of Los Angeles, last night we saw the full impact of the curfew with our ability to police areas of downtown and particularly and also the west side, but also the valley, where we saw roving groups of individuals that were not compliant with the curfew and we believe were out to loot and prey upon businesses and in our community. And our officers' actions were able to make to identify those individuals and make a number of arrests. Last night, just under 700 arrests. And within those 700 arrests were 70 individuals who were either burglarizing or looting, victimizing businesses further. So what that tells me is that two things. We didn't have protests last night. We had criminal acts. We didn't have people mourning the death of this man, George Floyd. We had people capitalizing. His death is on their hands as much as it is those officers. And that is a strong statement. But I must say that this civil unrest that we're in the midst of, we must turn a corner from people who are involved in violence.
Well, that's a pretty irrational statement there. How the looters can be held responsible for the death of George Floyd is really beyond any rational argument. But that's the chief's statement. And in L.A., they're now collecting evidence from video surveillance cameras, from officers' body cams, and other sources. And they've put out a call together with the FBI, inviting members of the public to submit their own footage. And this, you know, it sounds good on the surface of it, right? Citizens standing up to identify and prosecute lawbreakers. But you have to be concerned about how that footage will be used and whether they will deploy facial recognition technology, which is, it produces a lot of false negatives. And over at the ACLU, Jay Stanley is arguing that if the FBI is going to collect footage on lawbreakers, they should also seek video of wrongdoing by police officers. And I think fair is fair in that case. Paul Leto, a regular listener, emailed a post that he grabbed from somewhere. Here's an example of how white privilege sounds. You keep saying, it's horrible that an innocent black man died, but destroying of property has to stop. And he suggests, try saying, it's horrible that property's being destroyed, but killing innocent black men has to stop. I think that's a thoughtful expression. Also, we're seeing that worldwide, people are expressing solidarity with the protesters in the United States, rejection of the clear racism that is a part of American daily life. And get this, Boris Johnson's foreign secretary, Dominic Raab, this is in London, of course, spoke in language more often deployed when discussing intractable conflicts elsewhere in the world. We want to see de-escalation of all those tensions and Americans come together, he said. Then the head of the African Union Commission condemned the killing of George Floyd, lamenting continuing discriminatory practices against black citizens in the United States of America. The German foreign minister said the U.S. protests were both understandable and more than legitimate. Quote, I can only express my hope that the peaceful protests do not continue to lead to violence, but even more express the hope that these protests have an effect in the United States. So we live in a bubble that is supported and protected by our media. That we're the good guys and, you know, we're post-racism here in the United States. The Supreme Court said we don't need the Voting Rights Act enforcement anymore. Australia, fresh protests are planned this week. Here's a statement from the nephew of an Aboriginal man who died in Australian police custody in 2015. We're outraged about what's happening in Minneapolis, but really, us guys home in Australia need to take a stand together here because they can actually see the racism and injustice against our people. So protests have occurred in Toronto, Berlin, London, and other Western cities. Every day I like to remind you that we have funds available for $100 grants from the Peter B. Collins Podcast Community Fund. If you could use $100 to buy groceries, fill up your gas tank, or just to squeak by at this difficult time, get in touch. Drop a line to my email, peter@peterbcollins.com, and we'll be happy to consider your request. Well, today is Blackout Tuesday, and a number of artists, including Rihanna, the Rolling Stones, Drake, Quincy Jones, Billie Eilish, are participating in a Blackout Tuesday. They are not tweeting or posting on Facebook, and I pledge to do the same, except that when I post my podcast, it automatically tweets and puts up a Facebook post that Facebook buries. But beyond that, I will hold the line and not tweet or post on Facebook. Tomorrow at noon in Eastern time zones, congressional candidates from coast to coast who are progressives and people of color are going to hold a press conference supporting Black Lives Matter and articulating the policies that they would support if you elect them. And they include San Francisco candidate Shahid Buttar. He's running against Nancy Pelosi. Cori Bush in the 1st District of Missouri. Isaiah James in Brooklyn's 9th District. And Samelis Lopez, candidate for New York 15th Congressional District. Meanwhile, the protests at Facebook continue. And today, a software engineer. And I know a few engineers in Silicon Valley. They're not terribly political. But Timothy Aveni announced his resignation in a post on Facebook and at LinkedIn. He said, speaking of Mark Zuckerberg, "Mark always told us he would draw the line at speech that calls for violence. He showed us on Friday that this was a lie." And he continued, "Facebook, complicit in the propagation of weaponized hatred, is on the wrong side of history. Facebook is providing a platform that enables politicians to radicalize individuals, glorify violence. And we are watching the United States succumb to the same kind of social media-fueled division that has gotten people killed in the Philippines, Myanmar, and Sri Lanka. I'm scared for my country, and I'm done trying to justify this." Well, I salute you, Timothy Aveni. So Zuckerberg moved up a planned company-wide chat from Thursday to today. He continued to defend his tough decision, saying it was pretty thorough. He said Facebook's principles and policies around free speech show that the right action where we are right now is to leave up Trump's post about shooting and looting from last Friday. And he said, "I knew I would have to separate out my personal opinion, knowing that when we made this decision we made, it was going to lead to a lot of people upset inside the company and media criticism that we were going to get." So that struggle continues. Here's today's COVID-19 update, edited by Linda Lewis. Worldwide, there are now more than 6.2 million cases reported, leading to COVID-related deaths of 375,000 people. 105,000 of those are in the United States. And Governor Cuomo in New York reports that new cases in his state have reached an all-time low. We do have to be concerned about how these protests are going to possibly cause a new wave of infections. Yesterday, we reported that Italian doctor Alberto Zangrillo said that the coronavirus has weakened. There is pushback from Professor Françoise Bellou, who is director of University College in London's Genetics Institute. He said the composition of the viral population has not changed much since it emerged. Quote, "Viral load swab tests will vary over the course of an infection. When compared on the same day post-infection, viral load can correlate with symptom severity." He also noted that transmission outdoors is likely to be characterized by lower infectious dose and less severe symptoms than transmission indoors. Zangrillo responded, "We have never said that the virus has changed. We said that the interaction between the virus and the host has definitely changed." There is now a report from the Democratic Republic of Congo of a new outbreak of Ebola in Equateur Province. The Ministry of Health there reports 6 cases so far. U.S. Surgeon General Jerome Adams told Politico yesterday, "Based on the way the disease spreads, there's every reason to expect that we'll see new clusters and potentially new outbreaks accelerated by these public protests of the past week." And Dr. Amy Edwards, a pediatric infection disease specialist at University Hospitals in Cleveland, said people attending protests are shouting, talking, singing while in close proximity for hours, and these activities expel more droplets containing the virus than normal breathing. Dr. Anthony Fauci said that it's been 2 weeks since he last spoke or met with Donald Trump. So apparently the role of the task force is now behind us because Trump has vanquished the coronavirus because Trump. Also, we're learning that for as much as 1/3 of the people entitled to unemployment checks, they have not yet received a single payment. Now, this is shocking. Here in California, self-employed people like me had to wait until the first week of May to apply, and the first payment came within a week. And that was despite problems in the early stages here of rolling out massive unemployment payments during the first month of the shutdown. Trump is continuing to demand a Republican convention in Charlotte with no face masks, mobs of people, and no social distancing. I guess he really wants people to prove their loyalty to him and to his cause. And finally, today is an election day in Pennsylvania, Iowa, Indiana, New Mexico, the District of Columbia, and a couple of other states. And it appears that Trump's repeated criticism of voting by mail is affecting the behavior, but only of Republicans. Because with the coronavirus and now the chaos on the streets, there are many Republicans who did not file for an absentee or a mail-in ballot. And the numbers are pretty stark, where there's a huge Democratic advantage, at least in voter participation. So, for example, in New Mexico, 71% of mail ballots returned as of Monday were from Democrats. In Iowa, Democrats requested 56% of mail-in ballots. In Indiana, 350,000 Democrats requested mail ballots compared to 268,000 Republicans. And in Pennsylvania, the number is upwards of 70%. So this becomes an almost self-fulfilling prophecy on Trump's part, where he said that if we vote by mail, a Republican will never get elected. And it's because of the ruckus and the concerns about mail-in balloting, they're all rigged, it's all fraud, that appears to have drastically changed the behavior of his Republican Party voters. It's amazing. Thanks for listening to my daily news and comment podcast. You're free to share it everywhere. You'll find it on YouTube. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.